It's a look in time while you're chatting on Skype. Blow up, close your windpipe. Throw a massive car wreck. Get stabbed in the neck. Blow a life jacket in deep. Hurricane Sandy. Carbon monoxide. The state sponsored genocide. At war with the nation. A botched home invasion. Irano, erotic, extinct. Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This TEP episode is entitled The Anxieties of Activism, or, if you will, The Joys of Disobedience. And it is about the emotional baggage that comes with, along with standing up for your rights. Our guest for this episode is a little... As someone who knows a little something about civil disobedience, Mr. Clint Benjamin of the, shall we say, you're from the Adjunct Faculty Association and various sundry organizations. Say something about yourself, Mr. Benjamin.
Well, as you've so wonderfully pointed out, my name's Clint Benjamin. I'm an adjunct professor at a variety of institutions, and I am, I guess, a part-time agitator as well for the Adjunct Faculty Association of United Steelworkers.
Yes. Yeah, so why don't you just get a better job? Like, why not that? I mean, isn't there something you could do with mortgage-backed derivatives or something that probably would not lead to activism, but being actually a productive member of society?
Yeah, I guess that's the free market response, is get another job, you know. But
which you've actually done. I mean, currently you're splitting how many plates? Three plates.
I think there's the idea of sunk costs, to speak about an economic term that I only know a little bit about, but that's never stopped me before. I mean, I've invested so much of time and effort and money. And student loans into something that hopefully that I've, you know, will eventually pay off. You know, I think I'm in it to win it in terms of the adjunct stuff, but I also think that the education, the teaching is a bit of a calling, and I want to stick with that as long as possible. Although, you know, certainly the get another job demons have got at least a portion of my year at present, because it hasn't been particularly fun as an adjunct.
It's not fun, it's not lucrative, and I guess full disclosure, I'm sort of a semi part-time agitator in my spare time as well, which is how we know each other. And so what I wanted to talk about is what does it take to get to the point where you are and I sort of am? I mean, to have, you know, public protests or sort of sometimes go where you're not wanted or where the cops will show up or whatever. Like, what does it take? How did you get to that point?
That's an interesting question, Matt, because,
thank you. You know, I have my doctorate.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, I'm not the paragon of moral courage that now sits before you. I didn't come out of the chute, you know, throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails. I was a scared Stanley when we first started doing this kind of stuff and talking about it. You know, I was really worried about losing the old, you know, the lucrative adjunct jobs, plural. So that was a problem. But then I got to thinking about it, and, you know, and sadly, I kind of came up with, you know, laying in bed, staring at the ceiling, you know, kind of these questions like, well, what would Jello Biafra do? What would Joe Strummer do? And, you know, not sit back, certainly, and humbly take this, you know. And sadly, you know, and there's also this corny mantra that I think, you know, I want to make the world better, for a better place for my kid, you know, and certainly trying to do something better for adjuncts and you know, my colleagues is certainly, you know, yes, I'm not completely selfless, but, you know, the idea of making the world a better place or making education a better place in the going down in the future, you know, is certainly a better option than the status quo.
Yeah, which is so true, and I like the way you put that, too, this whole, you know, it kind of comes gradually, or it's something people sort of work on. I was talking to, and I can't say any names, but it was somebody, it was a colleague whose husband also teaches at a local university. And she said to me, you know, well, so-and-so, my husband was kind of on the fence. Don't say anything to anybody, but my husband was on the fence about this. But then he decided that it was all a good idea and it's what people should be doing. And I was sort of, I realized for me that was a moment where I was like, well, actually, you know, I think everybody who's involved, probably in any kind of activism, I think there's almost this expectation sometimes that, like, people either have the right idea from the beginning or they should have the right idea from the beginning, and it's not a process, and it's not an evolution, and it's not something that people kind of come around to or figure out. And that's kind of a weird, and I wonder if sometimes that weird pressure kind of like paralyzes people from doing anything or thinking, you know, or sort of exercising their political animal, which mm-hmm. I guess in some ways is what you're doing. Right, is exercising the political animal.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, for me, it was just gradually, I think, you know, there is a realization, what do I have to lose? You know, at the end of the day, if I were to be fired from my glorious adjunct positions, you know, I could probably find, you know, a better paying, well, I don't know, I'm an English major, but, you know, a better paying position or, you know, something like that. But the same time, if we do supposedly care about, you know, education and, you know, if children are our future, then we need to really crank up the volume on what's going on. And I think the time is right. You know, the adjunct conditions and the adjunct story, you hear a story about the degradation and the ignominy of adjuncts, you know, almost, you know, there's like two a day now.
Yeah, no, and I think that in and of itself is, you know, something, you know, because I was an adjunct for 7 years, you know, and there were years when I made $12,000 professionally, you know, or I would be 20-something and I had no dreams of ever possibly making more than my age, which is... Wouldn't that be nice if you just make your age, at least when you're in your 30s, make your age, or in your 20s, make your age. I just, actually, last year, I think, was the first year I made my age, you know, but, no, it is this weird thing, and there was this kind of feeling, I remember when I was doing it, of kind of suffering in silence, and if anything, it was this sort of open secret, like, yeah, your job really sucks, and even... school administrators would sort of say, hey, your job really kind of sucks. And people would kind of be grumpy in the faculty lounge or something, but that was kind of it. Mm-hmm. And it's this interesting thing that's happened like in the last year now where there's almost this risk of people getting kind of tired of people telling their story. You know, mm-hmm. It's this weird place where it seems like it's everywhere, but I think outside of our bubble, maybe it's still nowhere.
Right. I would agree with that. And I know with me, it was an issue of, you know, self-esteem. And I always wondered, you know, hey, you know, I'm good enough to be an adjunct, but am I good enough to be full-time? And then clearly, you know, with my... resounding in the past 6 or 7 years, zero job offers. Well, you know, well, Benjamin, you know, that's exactly that. That's a, you know, a fulfillment of those insecurities. You're not good enough. You know, you are a stinky adjunct. But then, you know, and I think that's another thing. You get the stink of the adjunct on you. You know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And that's damaging for many people. But then I got to thinking, well, you know, this whole academe thing maybe isn't necessarily a meritocracy, and maybe that's the delusion that I am trying to, you know, go through without blowing my brains out. You know, because you know, those kind of thoughts do pop up every so often. You know, especially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's an important part of it. I guess, you know, I was someplace, I won't say where, and they made some really kind of disastrous tenure track hires in my department. And it was just sort of like, how? What? Where? Who? You know? Mm-hmm. Even where I went to graduate school, there were some people who were sort of leftovers from an era when everything was, hey, do whatever, man. We're just, it's, school's just a party, you know? And they were, you know, not pulling their weight. And that becomes kind of, I know that that's a rage that has driven some people mm-hmm. into kind of like saying, you know, I'm not going to keep quiet. I'm going to do shit. I'm going to say shit. I'm going to at least tell my story about how much this all sucks.
Yeah. And I mean, just looking at some of our colleagues that we know, we don't need to name names, but, you know, if anything's based on merit, we can probably go through it, you know. A list on both of our digits, thinking of people that certainly are worthy and should have a part-time job, a full-time, a tenure track position.
No, absolutely. You know, and I guess it's, you know, there's that Mark Busquet thing about, you know, it's not a market anymore, it's a system. Mm-hmm. There's been this concerted effort to make labor cheap. There's been this concerted effort to disempower people. And I think, you know, to kind of go back, to loop back to this kind of anxieties of activism thing, it's still, though, I think it's still a big leap. It's a hell of a leap to say, you know, I'm going to do something against the system, or I'm going to question the mm-hmm. system. And as much as, if you think about it, you know, scholars in the humanities or whatever, aren't we supposed to be people who ask the big questions and live out that horrible Dead Poet Society fantasy. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to tell you about the meaning of life and we're going to talk about real things, but then not actually turn that into action, or not turn that into, I'm going to fucking do something about the world. Like, I've asked a big question about myself.
Right.
I've gotten this answer, now we do something about it. And that's still something that's really damn difficult for people.
Yeah, and I think that just the nature of the game in academia is that you're doing things by yourself, right? You don't necessarily call a colleague and say, hey, I've got a problem with this syllabus. Can you help me out? Right? It's not something that's, you know, you may have a colleague you have a beverage with, but it's not something that you... I mean, how collegial are colleagues, right?
Yeah, and, well, I think, too, there's also this whole thing about this, you know, culture of achievement and culture of esteem mm-hmm. that comes in higher ed. And in that sense, you know, there was... I remember seeing a journal article a few years ago that, you know, let's face it, like, college teaching, it's like sex. You know, other people have done it, but do you really want to ask? And right. And do you really want to see how good you really are? You know, there isn't like an objective third eye there saying, well, you know, sir, you could
right.
probably should have put your hand, you know, like there's not that. But it's that same anxiety, like you hate being caught doing it, but you know other people have done it, you know, and it's this open secret. And mm-hmm. so that's part of it. And it's part of the getting over the sense of, yeah, shame, like, why haven't I been successful stuff? So that's part of it. But when there's an action, we talk about, like, what goes through your head when it's time for public protest. And because I asked this question because I asked my students last week, we were reading a novel called... Purple Hibiscus by Chimamanda Adichie. And one of my favorite lines in that novel is, you know, it takes place in Nigeria in the 80s, and there was this military coup and they didn't value higher ed, and so they stopped paying professors and they stopped doing maintenance on, you know, putting any budgetary, you know, effort behind the universities. Not that that sounds anything familiar like what's
no
going on.
No parallels there whatsoever.
Yes, none
right?
at all. And but those dudes rioted. And at one point, one of the characters was accused of inspiring the students to riot. And so the line that this character had was, since when do students need an excuse? Since when do students need someone to tell them when to have a riot? And so I asked my students, is there anything that you would riot over? Is there anything that you would get out in the streets and tip over a cop car and break some glass?
They said no, right?
They couldn't even imagine. They couldn't even imagine. And I guess one of them said, well, maybe if I was really angry about something, maybe I would be a protester. And it was just like it was not even on their sense of what's possible in the world. It was like asking them, well, what would you do if time travel, you know, was the thing? Where would you go first? You know, that might have been an easier question to answer, actually.
Yeah.
Which is something that's utterly impossible.
Usually they kill Hitler and then do something else, right?
You know what? You know, if you had access to a time machine, do you really kill Hitler first? I'm just going to say that. I'm not... Yeah. I mean, you could get to killing Hitler. You know, I would maybe take out the person who invented aluminum siding, or at least sold the aluminum siding mm-hmm. to the people that owned my house in the 60s. Maybe. And then I'd get around to Hitler. I'd get to it. It would be on the list. But
certainly.
If you're time machine, you're totally decoupling time and space.
Yeah.
You can get to killing Hitler.
Well, exactly. There's no rush if you've got a time machine.
Exactly. I was like, yeah, I'll kill Hitler. Don't worry. I want to have some fun first with
right,
this or something.
Right.
There's
historical concerts to be seen.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then you kill Hitler. It's okay. But it was so interesting, this idea, even the thought of protest.
Right.
You know, which was a part of public life or political life before we even had democracy. I mean, people protested under kings and popes and all of that. That yeah. people don't understand that you can still do that, or that that's important.
The tenor of protests have changed too. I think some of our students just like, you know, what's the deal with those weird, annoying protesters? Whereas I think you'd see in the, you know, Not that I was around for the 60s, I think you'd see some spontaneous uprisings, you know?
Yeah, or people thinking, you know, they could take the power back, or, you know, at another university I was teaching, I gave the example of what happened in France in 1968. And students were like, yeah, but what would that accomplish?
Mm-hmm.
And I can say, well, look what they accomplished. And
look what they accomplished in Quebec, right?
Yeah. Well, you better explain that now. You threw out that historical reference.
Well, I just, I mean, in terms of deep historical knowledge, there was a chain, or there was an issue in Quebec, and I have to brush up on what the students were actually pissed off about.
I believe it was tuition.
Yeah.
I believe it was tuition related to government support of higher
yeah.
ed.
And I think you're right, and I think they just, you know, they weren't having it. They got out on the streets. You know, it wasn't a bit, you know, it didn't seem like it was particularly, you know, orchestrated. They
yeah.
got out there and were, you know, making noise, kicking a little tail, you know, and as far as I know, they got, they at least had, that helped change the discussion in Quebec.
Yeah, which I guess that's one of the anxieties, too, or the weird things, is that since it is so foreign and so alien to Americans now,
mm-hmm.
you know, I remember people, I don't know how many folks said during Occupy, why don't they just go to a hotel?
Right.
Which is sort of like
mm-hmm.
the senselessness yeah. of it. And they weren't being ironic. They were seriously questioning, like, if we're going to go out and protest, why don't you get a hotel and then
right.
go down to the city square, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, Occupy was pretty exciting. There is some, you know, sad footnotes to it, but I think that really showed people, you know, that that kind of thing can be germane and effective again.
Yeah. But so what goes through your head on the day of an action? Like when something is going down, you know, or you're going to put on the Santa suit or...
Well, Nate, I don't know if should use his last name, but Nate, a colleague of... Well, an associate of ours, an acquaintance of ours, said that...
Co-conspirator.
Yeah, said that... I believe he remarked that, Benjamin, you've always got a costume on when you do these things. And I, you know, I haven't done a ton of these, but he is accurate. He's right. And maybe there's some sort of a psychological, transference there. I kind of loathe the term activist anyway, but, you're active, right? But I prefer rabble-rouser or agitator, but I suppose that's all semantics. But, there is a lot of adrenaline, which for an old dude like myself, there isn't much of that around. But it is, I think it's more nervous energy because, us academic types aren't necessarily, standing in front of tanks in Tiananmen Square. I mean, what have we ever had to do in terms of direct actions that have really been that, confrontational or whatnot? I mean, for me, not so much. But at the same time, when up against authority, I would probably, in my civilian attire, just say no, yes sir, no sir, but... Like we've discussed before, I think you have to step up and, do something at this point. The time is now.
Yeah. And I always think about, so my days whenever I'm going to something, and I don't even know if this is true or not, but somebody I know somewhere posted on Facebook when Occupy was happening and they were part of the big march, that if you end up in county... and you have white underwear, they let you keep it. And so that's usually the first decision or the first thing I do that day is remember, oh, yes, I better put on. Which is such a weird... And then I have this thought, usually while I'm still naked, just thinking, what the fuck has happened to my life? That this is now on my radar. And that anxiety of like... I could get arrested today. And I'm putting myself in a position where possibly... I could be, and I didn't imagine this for myself a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was not involved. I was just kind of angry and alone.
Yeah.
Until last April.
Well, I think that there's been a great wellspring and of group courage too. I think more people are starting to come out for this stuff.
Yeah.
I truthfully didn't know that. I have not heard that the thing about the whiteys in the county. I don't even know if that's true or not.
That might have been something. The person was kind of an old hippie, so that might be a leftover from the 60s.
Yeah.
But I was just like, okay, I better,
Yeah, I guess I better get some briefs. Hello, hello, ladies.
Yes, hello, ladies. Oh, good thing we have bodies for radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
definitely. Of course, I have a voice for print, too.
No,
so
geez.
That's not helping anybody out. But there is that moment of like, oh yeah. Shit, it's real.
Yeah, there is. I mean, it's a non-zero percentage, I think, at this point. It's not huge, but it's definitely you're rolling the dice.
And I guess if you're like me and you follow Gawker on Facebook, Gawker Salon, Glenn Greenwald, and the Huffington Post, there is sometimes the stories of activist protesters that the police just go fucking apeshit on.
Mm-hmm.
And there is that, when we even had that joke, our mutual friend, the Andrew McCutcheon of the movement, didn't you say something about, wonder if he got tased. That would be great if we get that on YouTube. Which is kind of funny, and we wouldn't wish that on that person.
Right.
But he could get tased, and it's...
Yeah, that would be sobering. I don't think it... Although, it'd be kind of great, I think, if somebody did overreact like that. It'd be, from a strategic standpoint, we're giving away all of our secrets here, I guess.
Well, I mean, it would be something where, the weirdness and the brutality of it kind of would be open, of the system. I think about moments, there's a couple times, there was one time where at one of the actions, we went into the street when we weren't supposed to block the street. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, as I'm standing in the street with a bunch of other people who aren't supposed to be there at that moment, oh, this just got real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. Or when we were protesting against, I can talk about this one, UPMC, and we were going up the steps of the U.S. Steel Building. And this is where maybe where the other part of the title comes through. You know, that security guard came out, and I thought he was going to blow a gasket. I mean, the vein in his forehead was throbbing.
Maybe it was just a very vascular gentleman. I don't know.
Yeah, but maybe. He was yelling, and mm-hmm. it was cold, and he wasn't even wearing a coat. And I was thinking about that as that was a moment where I was like, oh, is this going to get out of control?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the protest where some stuff's going to happen? But then the other part of it is like, oh my God, check out that security guard. He is mm-hmm. so pissed. Mm-hmm. And you know he's just another working dude just trying to get through his day.
Right.
But there is this profound, deep satisfaction that I think comes from all of this too. That there is stuff that's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real joy of like, we're being bad. Like,
yeah,
tweaking
of the nose.
We're 12 years old, really. I mean, right. Doesn't that like tweak your inner 12-year-old? Of like,
I think it
yeah!
does. Yeah. I mean, I've always been a kind of mischievous at heart. So it's nice to a trickster, if you will, in the old.
No.
I mean, I've been giving myself way too much credit here, but
The Santa suit thing was pretty good.
Well, thank you. But I think that there's that element, and that kind of appeals to me. But I think you've got to take kind of a surreal comic quality to a lot of the things you're doing. That's how I try to approach it, is trying to make things silly. I mean, the people that have the power against us, I think, are also probably not accustomed to this, especially not humble pipsqueak wimpy adjuncts trying to...
Yeah, or I sometimes think that what happens to people in power, and I think my experience going to meetings, or we at least get people to come to meetings to have mm-hmm. discussions, is they're, you know, they probably live in such a bubble where the only people that they interact with are people who are sort of on their level mm-hmm. of their class, maybe interacting in a way with people that they kind of have a halo over them, or they're prestigious, or they're important, or people care what they think and all of that stuff. And I think you can kind of, in that bubble, you can kind of build up some sort of like momentum, like a wind that hits no obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
And in just not used to being thwarted.
Indeed. Right.
You know?
Yeah, I can't determine on a side note, is this the like response to the adjunct crisis from administration, is it because they're so out of touch, or is there actually a force of malignancy on their behalf, or maybe both?
I think maybe both. I think, you know, with sort of one of the university presidents that we've dealt with in this movement, I genuinely think that here's a person who has never been told no before, or it's been years before. They've kind of, since they've been told no.
The George Lucas of college presidents, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And then suddenly, no, like, how do you do with that? I mean, that was sort of like bad example or good example. Remember when Kobe Bryant was accused of sexual assault?
Mm-hmm.
And the first game the Lakers played in Denver, he got booed mercilessly for 48 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on Pardon the Interruption afterwards, which was, I think, a show that almost is an influence on the podcast. But anyway. And he said, I had no idea people didn't like me. And Kornheiser and Wilbon were just so freaked out by that. But luckily, they had the American philosopher Charles Barkley on the next episode. And he said about how, it's like, no, you don't. And they asked him, and he said, no, you don't understand. He's probably never been told no before. he pays everybody in his inner circle to hang out with him. No one's ever going to call him on any of his BS. And there's so many people like that in the league who are just in that bubble where they're never kind of thwarted.
Mm-hmm. And obviously administration's kind of the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people in modern life, I mean, if you remember the I Want a Whopper commercials for Burger King, and now there's national story that there's a Burger King in our town that's not really a Burger King, and people are freaking out over it. It's not really Burger King! Oh my god! This is, you know, and like that's the crisis people had. And so that on those I Want a Whopper commercials, like somebody gave them a Wendy's burger instead, mm-hmm. and people flipped the F out.
Right.
I think a lot of our lives, I mean, think about how mad people get when stuff breaks.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're thwarted or whatever, how impatient people are. And I just think that people who have some prestige and some power, I think are that to a even more ridiculous degree. And to then suddenly be in a space and a time and a moment where people are saying no, or people are saying, you are doing wrong, sir,
mm-hmm.
is... Well, I don't know if they have a skill set for that anymore. You know, can they draw on when they were 20 and struggling, if they were ever that?
Yeah, I think you see that. I don't necessarily want to target rich folks, but, you know, the so-called affluenza or the studies that show that, you know, people that are wealthy have less empathy, you know, than us, you know, Joe Sixpacks and whatnot.
Well, I think there's also, too, there's something to be said, and I think it's part of the joys of disobedience, is that it is this collective experience, and that you're with people, and people are doing it, too, and mm-hmm. that's part of the, maybe also the fun and the naughtiness, and the joy of it is that you have these, you know, what I feel now, I think, and again, I didn't get involved in any of this until, what, April of last year? April 2013, and I already feel like it hasn't been a year, but I feel like I have some really close, hopefully lifelong friendships that just kind of arose out of
I think
being in the right place in the right time and, you know, going to the right marches, mm-hmm. you know?
Which doesn't really necessarily happen when you get to be as old as we are, you know? Our friends are usually set at this point, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it evens the playing field for a lot of our colleagues who we never see, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, hey, this guy feels this way, this gal feels this way, something like that. Another thing is the fact that I don't know, did you ever feel that you I never really felt this way completely, but there was an inkling that I was above such nonsense because I was...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I... You know, I had a couple cool experiences before kind of standing up or writing bitchy letters or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I do the snarky letters so well, which I haven't unleashed yet, really, in this movement, but I have to. But I had this great experience in college where the Ku Klux Klan came to Ebensburg and they wanted to hold a rally on the courthouse steps. And I went, and it was January or February. I think it was January, and it was super cold. And I went, and I just figured, well, I gotta go. And somebody kind of talked me into doing it. But there's that other fear, I think, on anxiety of activism. When you go to have a march or an action, what if nobody shows up? Mm-hmm. That's one of the fears, too. What if nobody shows up? And then, two, I just was like, oh, God, the Klan, and they're evil. And, in fact, like where we were at in Cambria County, there was the real risk, because if the Klan knew you didn't like them and they would find out where you lived, they would leave flyers on your car. So you'd come out to your car in the morning and there'd be a flyer to let you know that there was somebody outside of your house and near your car, you know, and that's scary. And so, like, I had to, like, park my car way far away, and somebody who was already on the Klan's shit list gave me a ride in and stuff. But then it turns out that there were, like, 6 people to promote to go, yay, Klan, and about 30 of us, they were like, fuck you, you know?
Yeah.
And I got to tell this story, too. Well, actually, a couple things. One, somebody handed me an application. Things I lost in moves. Somebody handed me an application to join the clan.
That's almost priceless, I'd say.
Yeah, I lost it.
Although I don't know, what do you do with that? It's nice to have, but that's something you can frame and display.
Yeah, but it's like, this is a weird artifact from the world.
Yeah.
But then the other thing that happened was, these folks came from this organization in Columbus, came out, and they had these stickers that said Stop Racism. And there was this one young lady and she had this like army jacket, and she had like Germany patches and swastika patches, and and somebody stuck one of those on her back like a kick me sign, and everybody behind her started laughing, and so she turned to yell at them, and at the point in the spectacle of her yelling caused everybody that she was facing to look. And they read what was on her back, and they started laughing. And so she turned around and started yelling at them and exposed her back to a new group of people. And it was sort of like that Simpsons where they wrote on the back
insert
of Homer's head.
Here.
Yes, yeah. And he like ended up spinning out on the floor. Well, she turned around 3 times, not realizing that every time you turn around, people are going to laugh at you because they're going to see. And then one of her friends finally bear hugged her and carried her off to the side. And I was like, God, that's one of the greatest moments of my life. This stupid racist lady just got humiliated. And so, the security. And we all enjoyed it together. And I could have been warm today. And I think I almost got frostbite on my toes that day. But,
well, I got to say, the caroling for a contract was a lot of fun.
Yes, which is when you wore the Santa suit.
Mm-hmm.
I was sick.
Authorities out there, I was posing as Santa if you wanted to track me down.
Yeah, but also, though, isn't it a thing? We do these things, and there are cops! We were just at a thing where there was a cop. There was a guy with a gun. There was a dude with a gun checking us out, which is
potentially dangerous.
Yeah, right? And disconcerting and weird and...
Yeah. I've got an uncle who's a cop, God bless him, but they are state apparati, and I'll leave it at that, right? I do not like cops particularly. I've met a couple of ones that are all right, but generally, they give me the heebie-jeebies as a 5'7" man.
Yeah.
Hello, ladies. it doesn't. They're usually big and brutish and
armed and have tasers and mace power of the law and stuff.
Exactly.
Which that's a weird thing, but. Is it worth it?
I'm in it to win it. I'm not in this to lose, so eventually, it's going to be worth it. I mean, again, we're not, at this point, we're not Gandhi, we're not Bobby Sands, we're no hunger striker for anything like that, but it's an important fight, and gosh darn it, we're going to win, I think. Whether I'm doing this, 10 years from... Well, I hope we're not doing this 10 years
I know,
now,
that would be awful.
Yeah, but...
hopefully we'll be on to some new cause 10 years from now or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's if you care about education, and that should be a knee-jerk reaction. If you care about education, you're going to care about the treatment of adjuncts and the treatment of by extension, students or really anybody who's involved in this other than administrators, I suppose. And I met some nice administrators.
Yes. Yeah. And so would you say, what would you say to anyone in our position who's a little scared, who maybe wants to come to a meeting or come to a protest and doesn't? Or I think anybody who's just angry enough about something that they want to take control over their lives.
I don't want to necessarily render this into cliche, but there's that old Chicana poster, wall etching, I'd rather spend one day as a lion as opposed to 10,000 days as a lamb. I think I'm butchering that horribly, but you get the gist, right?
Yeah.
You've heard that, and I think that's the case. I mean, at some point you have to say, I need to stand up and be counted. The administration, power isn't going to magically, decide to, hey, we need to make improvements because somebody's been kind of, grumbling about it. That's never going to happen. things have to, you have to, power has to be shooken up from the bottom up sometimes.
Yeah.
And if you, I mean, I was scared too, and, you know, gee whiz, look where I am now. I'm dressing up in Santa suits, you know, painting myself up as a zombie, handing out cider for adjunct rights, you know.
You were in the city paper, you were the poster child. In the city, and the big color picture of you. Yes, I mean, you Google your name, and there's lots of great stuff that comes up. Yeah, and it's on the internet, so it'll never go away.
You know, I mean, speaking of fear, I wondered a couple of times. You know, such as it is, am I risking some sort of blacklist? You know, if you know, human resources were savvy at all, I think they might say, hey. Let's Google this cat. Maybe I should use an alias from here on in, but I mean,
Too late, probably. Yeah. It's way too late.
Yeah, if I
that ship has sailed.
If I don't get an adjunct position in Sheboygan, I think that's, you know, all that's all
why, to,
yeah, but that's something I've, you know, I've made my bed, now I have to lay in it, to use another cliche. Yeah. So.
But didn't you also once say, what, the more you speak out, the sort of stronger you become?
I think so.
Which is true. I think there becomes a thickening of the skin that happens.
Right, it's the old, you know, guitar playing calluses and, you know, weightlifting calluses. Those things, once you start repeating them over and over again, you get a muscle memory for it, and it becomes... I still get a little, you know, knock-kneed about these things, and even with one cop, I mean, I'm still like, oh, geez, but it's getting better, you know? Yeah. There's an inner reservoir of courage this cowardly lion didn't know he had, so I think it's a good thing.
All right. So on that note, I think it's now time for the bottom five.
The
bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Question one. Stock question one. For those of you who are regular listeners to the podcast, you would know that question number one usually is, if reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease would you be? Infectious disease or illness. Like, if you're disobedient, you totally screwed up and you had to go back to sort of single-celled organism that made people ill. What single-celled organism? It could be a virus, too.
Yeah, smallpox, I think.
Smallpox?
Yeah.
Kind of still a big deal in the global south, but kind of first world, not a thing. Or...
Yeah, you know, I'm happily residing in a lab in Atlanta right now as well. So there's that.
There's a degree of comfort
the
there.
The scourge of the world for many, many years, you know, and now I'm relegated to
test tubes.
Yeah.
Test tubes. Yeah. Climate-controlled test tubes. I could get that.
You know, in a museum almost, in a way.
All right, question two. What is the strangest injury you have ever suffered? Strangest way you've ever gotten hurt?
I've never really... Probably skiing, I guess.
Oh, God, you've been skiing.
I've been skiing, and I was told by my college buddy, you know, it was the last run, and I was an inexperienced skier. It was the last run. I think it was at, what's the local one? The Seven Springs?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this was on a school trip, and it's the last run, and I was an inexperienced skier, and it was like, well, we need to get down the hill to get to our respective bus and whatnot, and the quickest way down was a black diamond, and he's like, yeah, man, don't worry, just snowplow your way down, and I grasp the concept of the snowplow, but
what is the concept of the snowplow?
You make
a pizza with your skis. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, a chevron, if you will, with your but it didn't go well. I you know did a 50-yard face plant, and it ruined my modeling career. And you know, I vaguely remember making bad jokes, you know, go figure, to the ski patrol guys,
You know, and I had, you know, it was like one of those, in my face looked like, you know, I had gotten my ass kicked, but, you know, you should see the other guy, that sort of thing. But it was, yeah, that's probably the most embarrassing injury. I don't know about the strangest.
Yeah. Well, speaking of embarrassing, here's an embarrassing question. And this is, I just want a number. You don't have stories, but just have to do a mental calculation. Okay. Out of the people who have seen you naked, how many do you never want to speak to ever again?
Probably zero, truthfully. I mean, you know, if you're going to get naked with someone, you don't... And I'm pretty much, you know, agreeable enough, which might be a liability in these things, I think, that, you know, hey, if people are going to see you naked, you should foster some sort of...
lifelong relationship.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to be a lover, you don't have... But at least on spoken terms, right?
Yeah.
You know, speaking terms.
That's the best answer, I think, ever to that question. Because, yes, part of the joy of that question is, what's a good number? What's a fair number? You know, somebody said six, and it was like, is that high? I don't know.
Yeah. Really? Well, I mean, you have to go through the mental account.
Yes, the mental account, and you go, what were they doing?
Who's seen me naked? And then...
Yeah, and then... But, you know, it could be lovers, it could be, what if you played a sport in high school, or, you know, did the high school gym shower thing. You know, it could be a number of things.
Well, the good thing going forward, hello ladies, if you see me naked, I will definitely have some sort of, you know, awkward, you know, quasi relationship for the rest of our speaking
lives.
Yeah.
Good to know. Question four. Out of all the possible ways to die, what is the way you least want to die?
Drowning.
Drowning?
Yeah, I think that's terrifying. You know,
I will say, though, as someone who almost drowned, it's more peaceful than you think.
Yeah, I came close, and it was, for me, was not peaceful.
You didn't see the sun coming through the water, and it just kind of was a moment of zen there?
Great. The last time it happened, I was, the closest thing I came to was when I was about four or five, so it was a traumatic experience. I fell right into the pond. There's a whole Halloween, you know, it was the first time I was allowed to go trick-or-treating on my own, and that was, it allowed me to go over to my grandpa's house, which, for various weird reasons, and the fact my grandpa was a contractor, was our neighbor, and he essentially built those houses. So my costume, I don't know what the motivation was, but was a bag over my head, and it was, I don't remember am I supposed to be the unknown comic or just a guy with a bag on his head or whatnot? But
and that movie hadn't come out yet, Baghead. Yeah,
probably not Baghead. But I missed the bridge to this pond and went straight into the actual pond, and there was the double feeling of suffocation from the water. And I mean, I was overreacting. I was four or five at the time. There was like 6 inches of water tops, but the bag immediately got wet.
That's the principle behind waterboarding.
Mm-hmm.
Is the principle behind waterboarding.
So I self-waterboarded myself as a little kid, I guess. But it was, it was not, there was no serenity. It was terrible darkness, a wet bag on my head, chaos, you know, the end. So for me, it's drowning.
Drowning. Okay.
That being said, I have a deep fear of death and would prefer to live forever, but.
Oh, Lord. All right, question five. What is the strangest item you have eaten and or found in your stool?
Non-pica, or we're talking edible stuff, or...
Or not.
Yeah.
It just, it went down the throat, or came out the bottom. Which I think could be more terrifying, if something came out the bottom and you were like, did I eat that?
Yeah. I tell you, you know, I'll try to give you two answers. If you eat Oreos, which I... unfortunately do eat and have a propensity to eat a lot of them, it does turn the stool like a tar black.
Yeah, well, you know, that's because actually the Oreo stuffing is not... the human body actually can't break that
right,
shit down.
Right,
that but is not digestible.
But it was, you know...
the human body.
Who doesn't occasionally take a look at the work they've produced, so to speak, and...
Well, you know, there's that great Allen Ginsberg poem where it says, even Queen Elizabeth checks the bowl as a daily, you know, assessment of health.
Yeah. Well, it's good. It's good to do it, from what I've been led to believe. But that was kind of terrifying.
as to what I've ingested, golly.
Well, the creamy stuff in Oreos.
Yeah.
I think is...
Well, that's a delightful abomination, but an abomination nonetheless.
Yeah.
I've eaten bugs on it accidentally and stuff like that. I did have a dream once where I was eating something, then I awoke, and then I was eating some sort of beetle.
Oh, God! Oh, yeah. No! Yeah. That's bad.
I think that qualifies.
That's bad.
Yeah.
That's almost as bad as, you know, that dream where you're peeing and then you wake up and you're peeing.
Yeah. Fortunately, it will probably happen tonight. It's not happened to me yet, but
it happened to me, I will say, when I was 16.
Yeah.
It's been 20 years, and I'm still like, oh, God. Like, and when I get up in the middle of the night and pee, yeah. I always then have the, like, weird, wait, this is really happening, right? This is real life, isn't it?
But the beetle thing did happen. It was horrific.
So bad. That's so terrible. And on that note, I think that's about it. Now you have something though coming up. You do have something to hawk, right?
I mean, in a way, I'm. It's probably going to be greatest hits because sadly, as an adjunct, I haven't written a lot of new material. But I am reading at the Duquesne Reading Series Creative Nonfiction. I think you're going to get. Which is March 18th, I believe, in the Starbucks, not the Student Union Starbucks, but the one where the
on
bookstore
Forbes
is.
Avenue, yeah.
Yeah, the Forbes Avenue one.
What time is it?
I think 7 or 7:30.
Okay.
So, you know, all the cool kids are going to be there. Get your tickets early.
I'll try to be there. All right. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast. And we're all going to die on Facebook and Google+. I have a Google+ for this.
Excellent.
Oh, I forgot to update it for the last two podcasts. Oh, well. Thanks to Brett Zorick, as always, and like us on Google+. Thanks to Brett Zorick for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.
Later.